following program is presented by HAudio.com.
What I'd like to talk about today is a timely topic. Shavuos is in the air. I can already smell the cheesecake. And it seems appropriate to talk about the Ten Commandments. What I'd like to do with you tonight is to look at the Ten Commandments in the following light. It seems to me that as Jews, I'd like to question what sort of relationship we have on a personal level to the Ten Commandments. Which is to say, do the Ten Commandments as a document affect my life in any serious way? How do we relate to the Ten Commandments? We hear about, you know, fights in politics over whether the Ten Commandments should be displayed as a symbol in schools. And the truth is that many of the ways that we relate, I think, to this document, to the Aseret HaDibros, the Ten Commandments, is as a symbol. Every shul has their, you know, version of the Ten Commandments prominently placed above the Aron, above the Ark. And surely we view the Ten Commandments with a great degree of reverence. It's a symbol that inspires awe and reverence among us. But just because we revere this document does not necessarily mean that we're touched by the document. For example, as Americans, you can revere the Declaration of Independence. You can feel a sense of majesty coming to Independence Hall and seeing the original document, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the Declaration of Independence has any personal meaning to you on a day-to-day level. So I would ask the following question for you to consider honestly amongst yourselves. And I would ask myself the same question, which is like, when was the last time you were actually contemplating an act, whether to do the act or not do the act, and you actually thought of the Ten Commandments, and the Ten Commandments, you know, swayed your decision one way or the other? I don't know. I would venture to say not too many of us invoke the Ten Commandments on a day-to-day level. We think of things like davening. We think of things like tzedakah. We think of things like, you know, sending our kids off to school, going to shul, doing, you know, we have various religious things, but I don't know if the Ten Commandments is a document that touches us all that much. Certainly, if I haven't been considering murder lately, so does lo tirtzach apply to me? Does do not murder apply? Does it have anything to say to me? Or do I just relate to it as, you know, society has to live by these dictates, so it's a societal thing, but it really doesn't touch me as a person? The challenge I'd like to lay out tonight for you is to ask yourselves, is the Ten Commandments personally relevant to me? In other words, does it mean anything to me as an individual, not just to society as a whole, but to me as an individual? Can I look for the Ten Commandments to any kind of real practical guidance on any kind of day-to-day level, or is it just not that kind of document? So that's really the question I'd like to discuss with you here tonight. I think oftentimes when we approach topics in Chumash, sometimes we are so used to the text, we've read it so many times, you must have heard the Ten Commandments read in shul dozens of times, as you've heard other stories read in shuls dozens of times, that we tend to focus on minutiae. You know, the only time we can find something new to say is, you know, you figure out why the Torah said this word exactly instead of that word, or why Rashi phrased it in exactly this way. And those are the details, and the details are important to consider. But sometimes, in considering the details, we overlook the major question. Sometimes there's, I think, in any good piece of text in the Torah, there are little questions we can ask, but there's also what you might consider elephants in the middle of the room, and everyone's going around with a little magnifying glass, looking around for the little stuff, but there's an elephant there that nobody's seen. Many biblical stories have their elephants in the middle of the room, and I think the Ten Commandments has that as well. We can analyze the Ten Commandments in detail. We can look at particular commands and discuss their minutiae, but I'm interested in the big picture with you tonight. I'd like to ask a big picture question about the Ten Commandments as a whole. Let's start with the following and trying to understand its relevance. Why is it that we have Ten Commandments at all? That is to say, why is it that Ten Commandments out of the Torah, 613, were picked by God for some sort of special revelation at Mount Sinai? Now, this might seem like a strange question, but let me put it to you this way. If you ask you know, you stop, stand on the corner of, you know, Smith Avenue and Park Heights, and just, you know, take out a little piece of paper and poll the people walking by and ask them the following question. You know, what commandments do you have to keep in order to be a good Jew? Right? You may find that a great deal of the people who will respond to you will say, if I observe the Ten Commandments, I'm a good Jew. Right? I basically kept what God wants from me. Is that response correct or incorrect? Correct or incorrect? If you keep the Ten Commandments, you're a good Jew. You're doing everything that God expects of you. According to the Torah, is that true or not true? Not true. Right? How many commandments do I have to keep? 600. It says 603 commandments there that I'm not keeping if all I keep are the Ten Commandments. So it's not true that the only thing I need to be a good Jew is to keep the Ten Commandments. So I might then ask, so if there are 603 other commandments that are applicable to me, so why is it that 10 are singled out for a special revelation at Mount Sinai? Why? How is it that we relate to that? Let me consider a number of possible responses we might have to that question. Number one, one might argue that the reason why we have 10 commandments singled out of the 613 is because somehow these commandments are more important than the rest, as evinced by the fact that, let's say, they have more severe punishments for if you don't keep them than the rest of the Torah. Is that true? Do the Ten Commandments come with more severe punishments than all the rest of the commandments in the Torah? Is that true? No. How do you know it's not true? Give me an example of a commandment of the Ten Commandments that would not fit that model. How about number 10? Do not covet. What's the punishment for not coveting? Zilch. Right? The court will impose no punishment whatsoever if you covet. Right? It just isn't a command that you get. Now, there's lots of commands in the Torah which have capital punishment, which aren't in the Ten Commandments also. So there's no correspondence between the severity of the punishment and whether it makes it into the Ten Commandments. So you can't say it's just the big 10 that are in there. It's not the big 10. So then by what criteria are there 10 commandments here? So some people say, oh, well, you know what the 10 commandments are? The 10 commandments are God's laws for all of mankind. This is the basis of morality, the basis of civilization, and they're applicable to everyone. The 613 mitzvahs, those are for Jews. But the 10 commandments are universally applicable. Now that sounds nice. It's got a very nice appeal. We can relate to our Christian neighbors and say, yes, you can have the 10 commandments. We can have the 10 commandments. It's all very egalitarian and wonderful. But the problem is it true? Is it true that we demand from the Gentiles that they observe the Ten Commandments? No. How do you know? Okay, good. We have another system of law which is universal, and it's not the Ten Commandments. And there's not 10 of them, there's only 7 of them. Those are the 7 Noahide laws that we believe form the basic principle of morality that we hold all of the Gentiles to. We do not hold the Gentiles specifically to the Ten Commandments. In particular, one of the commandments in the Ten Commandments is to observe the Sabbath. We do not demand of Gentiles that they observe the Sabbath. You will not find Jews walking around, you know, even the most Orthodox Jews in Mea Sharim who demands that everyone's... He's not going to go walk into, into Hollywood and go, you know, rounding up celebrities and arguing that they need to observe the Sabbath. You know, if you're not Jewish, then you're not Jewish. It's not something which we demand of you. So if these are not universal laws, if the punishments for them are not more severe than any of the other laws, so then question number one is why were 10 picked at all for a special revelation? That is question number one. Question, and so let me ask you that. Why are 10 picked at all for a special revelation? Let me just throw in question number two before I let you answer that. Question number two is, our work is not done once we find the answer to that question. Once we find the answer to that question, we have a whole new question that rears its head, and that is the following. Once we figure out why we should pick any 10 for the 10 commandments, our next question is, why these? Right? Why these particular 10? And I would venture to say that if we did a poll right now, if we had little polling booths, and I gave you each a sheet of paper and a pen, and I gave you a list of all the 613 mitzvahs in the Torah, and I asked you to pick out your favorite 10 for the Ten Commandments, you know, the ones that you think should be the Ten Commandments, without regard to what the Ten Commandments after are, you pick the ones that you would pick for the Ten Commandments, I bet that not one of you would pick the commandments that are the same of anybody else. And not one of you would probably pick the exact Ten Commandments that are actually in the Ten Commandments, I would venture to say. We'll see. We'll look at the Ten Commandments in a moment and see whether that's true. But if so, why these in particular? So why any? Why choose any? And once we figure out why choose any, why choose these? Let's start with why choose any. Let's go with that. First, what do you say? Why choose any? What do you say? I mean, what did the Ten Commandments mean to you? What are these?
Well, they might have been put there because it's a good start.
Okay, what do you mean it's a good start? Let's refine that a little bit.
They are extremely important, each one of them. Just the ten of them is a basic framework of the life of what a Jew should live.
Okay, so we have one theory we could say is the good start theory. We might say that if you start with these, that what it makes observance of the others easier, would you say?
Or more amenable to observe them. In other words, if you have the basic of these ten, then when they tell you, don't eat kosher or something like that, then you understand that these just come much more naturally.
So once you get used to observing these ten, so you're basically ready. But the only thing is there an expectation that Moshe says, notice when Moshe presents these to the people, he doesn't say, start with these, here's your appetizer, right? In other words, there's some mitzvahs that come before, there's some mitzvahs come afterwards. It's not, because if that were true, then I would have thought historically the way it would work is that back in Morrow, which is even before the Ten Commandments, where God gives a few commandments, that those should really be the Ten Commandments, because that's sort of the introduction. So if it's literally just an introduction for everybody, then why weren't the Jewish people introduced to it that way as well? They actually got other mitzvahs as an introduction. So it's a possible theory, but that might be a problem. Any other theories? Why? What are we to make of the fact that there's ten? That we have ten commandments singled out for some special revelation? Moshe comes down with these tablets, right? And you say, what are these? You know, I thought we have 613. What are you doing with these ten, right? So what's the answer? Give me an answer to that question. Yeah?
I was going to say that maybe in some mystical way, all the remaining mitzvahs, the other 603, are contained in them.
Okay, so Rabbi Chiswell is advancing an intriguing theory, okay, which actually he says it's mystical, but it doesn't have to be so mystical, right? And Rabbi Chiswell's theory is the following. He says maybe these ten are somehow chapter headings, as it were, for the whole Torah. And that this is a framework, and I think you use that word also, that it's a framework for the Torah. It's really a modification. Your name was? Stanley. So if we modify Stanley's theory a little bit, and not so much that it's a start, but that it's a framework for the entire Torah, that's really the same as what Rabbi Chiswell is saying. And that is, maybe you can look at these Ten Commandments that it's not that they are more important than any others. It's not that you get more punishments. It's not that they're more universal. But what they are is sort of a thumbnail sketch for the entire Torah. If you want to understand the entire Torah, you can just look at the table of contents, and you basically got it. In other words, everything else is details, right? These are the chapter headings. This is the table of contents. And that if so, you would be able to subsume all of the rest of the 603 commandments, which are more detail-oriented, into these basic categories, much the same way. In the book, you have table of contents, you have chapters, and then there's stuff in the chapters. So there's roughly, 60.3 commandments per chapter you would put in there, and then you could break the Torah into this kind of framework. So that's an intriguing possibility, and it's one that's suggested by a number of our commentators. So we have a theory coming from this side of the room, which basically is, hold on for a second, which basically is that maybe we can look at the Ten Commandments as a series of chapter headings for the entire Torah. What I'd like to do with you for the rest of this evening is to test this theory. Okay? Let's test this theory and see whether we buy it. Okay? We're going to try and do, we're putting Rabbi Chiswell and Stan on the line here, right? We are going to test this theory and see whether we think that it really works. Okay? Now, in order to do so, I'd like to then go to the second part of our question, which is not just why have any Ten Commandments, but why have these? Okay? The question is, if The Ten Commandments are, in fact, chapter headings for the entire Torah. It is a daunting task indeed to pick out the Ten Commandments out of the 613, which you feel are going to be broad enough to actually be those chapter headings, right? And what I'd like to do is devise with you an empirical test that we can actually go through to test and determine whether, in fact, we feel that the Ten Commandments works as chapter headings for the entire Torah. Now, we don't have much time, so we're going to do this test real quick-like. All right? So here's what we're going to do. What I'd like you to do is to pretend for a moment, engage in a journey of the imagination with me, and here is what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to pretend that you are no longer in Baltimore. You're not in the chapel of Ner Tamid, but you have been transported to a boardroom on the 29th floor of a skyscraper in New York City where Random House has its headquarters, and you are not congregants in Ner Tamid, but you, in fact, are members of the editorial board of Random House, to whom a new book proposal has just been submitted via FedEx. Okay? A FedEx envelope has mysteriously materialized on the boardroom table in front of us with no return address. We open the FedEx envelope, we see a book proposal, open the first few pages, we see it is a table of contents. And we flip to the first page, the first chapter. It's the first chapter in a table of contents. There's a little sticky note on the top, which is that the author believes this will be the best seller of all time, right? This is going to be the Bible, right? And he has submitted the table of contents for our review, and believe it or not, he would like your feedback. Okay, just for the purposes of a thought experiment, I'd like you to imagine, we got a little sticky note. This is the rough draft, right, of my table of contents. Right, here's what the whole book likes. Here's the table of contents. What do you think? You know, I'd like your feedback. So the author wants the feedback, you know, that it comes from someplace in heaven. There's no return address, so we can't figure it out. But we're trying to figure out whether or not this would work as a good table of contents, okay? So let us begin our meeting. Our meeting is going to take about 6 minutes, all right? So this is a very accelerated editorial staff meeting here. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to spend the first part of our meeting, 3.5 minutes, we're going to devote to, before we actually go through the Ten Commandments, we're going to try to devise a list of criteria which we will use to determine whether or not any given commandment should be in the table of contents. So in other words, before we begin evaluating whether we think a commandment should be there or not, or whether we would modify it or whatever it is, we first want to know what are the kinds of commandments we would want in the table of contents and what wouldn't we. In other words, the rules of the game are the following. The 613 commandments in the book, right? The rules of the game are you can select 10 of these commandments to serve as representatives, which will then be chapter headings for all of the other 613. You have to select a commandment, right? Now, what criteria will guide us in our selection process? What kind of commandment do we want? What kind of commandment do we not want? Now, I don't mean what kind of commandment do we object to being in the Torah. Right? We're not in that business. What we're simply saying is there might be nice, very nice commands for the Torah, but they don't belong in the Ten Commandments. They don't belong in the Table of Contents. So I'd like from you is the following. What kind of command do you want in here? What are the qualities in a command that you would want to see? And what are the qualities in the command that you would not want to see? Can you give me a suggestion? Yes?
Well, I'd say you want ones that were general enough that other commandments could be incorporated in some.
Okay, good. So number one, I want general commands. I don't want commands that are too specific. There are many commands in the Torah that are very specific, right? On Pesach, right, you should eat matzah, and matzah is defined by the following 5 species of grains. That's a very nice commandment, but I do not want that in the Ten Commandments. It's much too specific. On all the sacrifices you bring, you're supposed to bring salt. Very nice commandment, but it doesn't belong in the Ten Commandments. I can't fit any other commandments underneath that. I need broad general commands. So number one is I want general commands as opposed to specific ones. What else do I want?
Well, if I was the editor of the book, I'd probably want a preface.
Good. So you would want a preface.
A preface is usually signed by the author. Okay. The first commandment is the sign. The author signs it because the first commandment is the signature of the author.
Okay, good. So you might say the first thing I want in the table, although we're talking about a table of contents now, but you might say that the first thing I want to see in the book is some identification of the author. You know, it's like in the front jacket cover, right? You want a little, you know who the author is. Maybe that's the first command, right? Maybe the first command is really a preface. That's an intriguing possibility. Okay, good. What else would you want to see in the Ten Commandments? Give me something else. Is general the only criteria, or do you have other criteria also? The only thing you want is general commands, or you want something more from commands? Yes?
It could be like a foundation.
Okay, you, not only do you want general commands, but you want fundamental commands. You want commands that you somehow intuit are really foundational and important that the rest of the Torah is built on. So you might have a very general command, but you might not feel that it's fundamental enough to be involved in the whole Torah, to somehow serve as a core for the whole Torah. You know, you might say the law that everybody has to gather and the three pilgrimage festivals at the temple is a general command. It's pretty general, but you might argue that it's not foundational enough. It's not fundamental enough to be in the Ten Commandments, maybe. So in other words, you would want general commands. You'd also want them to be fundamental, have a sense that they are the basis for the entire Torah. Okay, good. What else would you want? Is there anything else? Or are we done? Yes.
Man to man and man to God.
Okay, you might say that you want them divided into categories. Right? In other words, you might say that I don't want just a bunch of jumbled set. In other words, if I'm looking at a table of contents, I don't want it just to be a bunch of jumbled commands with no sense of order, but I'd like to see some logical progression. I would like to see commandments of a certain group grouped in a certain area. I want commandments of another group grouped in another area. I don't want them tossed together in a random kind of way. And you might even take that a little further and say that what I would want to see is some sort of logical progression. In other words, I would want to see how one thing leads into another. If you read a good table of contents, right, a good table of contents should give you an idea of the structure of the book. In other words, when you look at the book, you want to understand, what do I have in front of me? What does it look like? How does one thing lead to another? What are the transitions between topics here? If you have a good table of contents, you'll see there's chapters about this, that leads logically into chapters about that, and that leads logically into chapters about that. So you might want categories. You might want a kind of understanding of how one category blends into another, a logical flow, a logical order, a sense of unity in the book. Okay, good. Is there anything else you would want? I think we got a pretty good list. Anything else? I think you might want to know the title of the book, right? That's an interesting request. You might say, if you're picking 10 commands that would serve as a table of contents, could you pick one command to serve as the title? I mean, that's an intriguing question, right? Maybe there is a command that could serve as a title. And if so, what would it be? So we might address that in the sticky note back to the author. You know, we'd like to know what he thinks the title of the book should be. Is there anything else? I think there's one or two other things we would want. Yeah?
I just want to clarify, especially when you're saying title. You said before that this would be like the table of contents for the Bible. Are you saying really for the 613 commandments? Because it seems to be two different things.
You mean the narrative portions? The narrative portions of the Bible. Yes, that is a very good point. I'm looking right now that's an interesting question. When we look at the Ten, that's a very interesting question. I don't know the answer to that question. But the question is, when you see the Ten Commandments as the structure for something, as the chapter headings, in other words, when we go back to Stan Rabbi Chiswell's theory, so are they saying that this is the structure for the entire Torah, which means its commandments and its narrative portions also? Or is it just the structure for the commandments portion of it, and I'm seeing it as a structure in that way? I don't know the answer to that question, but that's an intriguing question. Let's leave that open for now. That's a good question. Okay, good. Is there anything else I would want to see in the table of contents? Anything else I want to see? Let me add one more thing. What I would want to see one thing I wouldn't want to see. Let's put it that way. Is there anything else you wouldn't want to see? I'll tell you something I wouldn't want to see. Remember, you've only got 10 commands. You've only got 10 slots to fill. You've got 603 commandments to get underneath those 10. So something you don't want to see in these 10 commandments, and that is unnecessary repetition. For example, if I represent one category, right, with one command, so I don't want three other of my slots to be taken up with more commands from that same category, right? I've got 603 commandments that I got again. You know, I can't afford to be wasting slots. Once I represent the category, I've represented it, it's time to go on to the next one. So I don't want undue repetition in this thing. I want a sense of evenness, of balance. I want the entire Torah to be represented in an even kind of way. You don't want it to all be bunched up over here or bunched up over there, right? Make sense? All right, we are done with this part of the meeting. It is time to move on. Let's go to the actual Ten Commandments now and read them through and see what we make of them. We're taking out our red pens. We're going to go through them. We're going to see what changes, if any, would we make to this list if we were the editors of Random House and this we were given this list of Ten Commandments. Okay, let's start with commandment number one, okay? I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt from the house of slaves. That is commandment number one. Does anyone raise an objection to commandment number one being in the list of Ten Commandments?
It's not a commandment.
Right, which is your point as well, which is, it's not a commandment, right? So what are you calling it the Ten Commandments for? Now, the answer to that might just be, we didn't call it the Ten Commandments, right? Because if you actually look at the Hebrew, you'll find that in Hebrew, it does not translate the Ten Commandments. If it did, in Hebrew, it would be the Aseret HaMitzvot, right? The Ten Commandments. But it's not the Aseret HaMitzvot, it's the Aseret HaDibrot, which means the ten what?
Words,
saying, things, right? They're things. They're not commandments. They're phrases. They're things. So things are much broader than commandments. So maybe they don't have to all be commandments. Truth is, a friend of mine, a colleague of mine in Near Israel, suggests that if you look carefully at the Ten Commandments, you'll find that you can make an argument that many of them are not commands. For example, right? What could be a more direct command than do not murder, right? Commandment number six. If you look carefully at do not murder, an intriguing possibility is that it's not actually a command. Now, that sounds really shocking, but listen carefully. How would you say do not murder in Hebrew? So murder is tirzach, but how do you say do not in Hebrew? Do you know how you say do not? You say al, okay? Now, that is the Hebrew word for do not, but that is not the word that the Torah uses. The word the Torah uses is lo. What does lo mean? No. So what it actually means is not do not murder. What it actually means is no you murder. Now, that's not very grammatical, right? No you murder. But if you think about it, which is a subcategory of which? In other words, if you had do not and no, right, which is more general, do not or no? No. Right? Do not is a subcategory of no. It's a certain kind of no. There's other kinds of no also. There's could not, should not, would not, might not, oughtn't, right? All of these things. One of them is do not. What he suggested is that maybe lo tirzach is really a statement more than it is a command. It includes do not murder, but it's not limited to do not murder. It's also you can't murder, you oughtn't murder, you shouldn't murder, you wouldn't murder, and you will not murder, and you may not murder. All of that tied together, it is no you murder. Right? It is a statement. If it's a statement, then really the Ten Commandments, it really revolutionizes the way we see them. It's not just directives and how we're supposed to live their life. It's setting out a path for us and saying, these are the ways of life that the Torah envisions them. This is it. These are the things here. Right? Part of the thing that's implied in those things is directives and commands, but it's not just commands. It's telling you the way to live with a capital L. All right, but if that's so we would keep Anochi Hashem Elokecha, perhaps, in the list. But let's move on. We have commandment number one, I am the Lord your God. Let's get to commandment number two. Commandment number two is, do not have any other gods before me. Okay? Could you raise an objection to commandment number two being in the Ten Commandments?
There are no other gods but our God. In other words, there's no gods. Only one God. Why do we have to mention another God?
Okay, why do we have to mention another God? So here's the question on the commandment, but the word God here is with a small g, not a capital G. So in other words, do not attribute power to any other beings and worship them as gods, is what it means. Okay, but now let me ask you this. Getting back to, can you raise an objection to this being in the Ten Commandments? Can you raise an objection to this being in the Ten Commandments? I think you can. What objection would you raise? Yes?
Two things. First of all, you said not to take up extra slots with repetition.
Good. Let's stop there. Hold on 1 second. I'll get to your other thing in a minute. But number one is yes. Right? One of our principles was no repetition. Right? We don't want harping on the same category. Why can't do not have any other idols before me be a subcategory of I am the Lord your God? I mean, you just devoted a whole category to I am the Lord your God. It would seem logical. You got 60.3 commandments to get underneath that thing. It would seem logical to put idolatry as one of them. Why are you devoting a whole new category to idolatry? So you might redline idolatry. Good. What else?
The other thing is, this one is kind of wordy. It's got a lot of other stuff
thrown in. Okay. We have a lot of details thrown in. Well, we've also got a lot of interesting words in it, which are actually rather strange. Let me tell you a couple of them. Number one, in this commandment, God describes himself as a jealous God. Right? Now, how is it that we relate to jealousy? Is jealousy a really nice kind of emotion? No, it's not such a nice kind of emotion. So how do we attribute jealousy to God? Why does God attribute jealousy to himself? What do we mean by attributing jealousy to God? That's question number one. Question number two is, what does it mean, those extra words, you should not have any other gods before me. What does it mean, you should not have any other gods before me? Not just you shouldn't have any other gods, you shouldn't have any other gods before me. What does before me mean? What does that mean in regular English? What? Okay, in front of, or really in my presence. In other words, if I'm here, don't have any other gods in my presence. That's actually an interesting saying. It's not just that the command is don't worship other gods, it's don't worship other gods in my presence, which is really odd. Almost as if, what, to imply, and if you're not in my presence, then you can worship them? How is it that we quite understand that? And how is it that we understand God as a jealous God? All right, so we may have some questions about this commandment, but surely it sounds repetitive, so we put a strike through that. We move on to commandment number three. Commandment number three is, do not take God's name in vain. Okay? Would you have any objections to level against do not take God's name in vain? No? Good? What? Same thing. I mean, you might say, come on, we're back to respect of God, right? We've already got respect to God. This is all part of number one. You might argue that. Actually, the question gets even worse when you look at the rabbinic interpretation of this command. Let me give you the rabbinic interpretation of this command. How did the rabbis understand you shall not take God's name in vain? Much differently than the way it's understood colloquially. The way the rabbis understand is that it prohibits certain kinds of oaths. There are certain kinds of oaths that you're not allowed to take according to the Torah. Specifically, there are two kinds of oaths that you're not allowed to take. One is known as a shvuas sheker, a false oath, and the other is known as a shvuas shav, which is a vain oath. Okay, there's a difference between a vain oath and a false oath, and only one of them is in the Ten Commandments. Let me briefly describe to you the difference between a false oath and a vain oath. Here is a false oath. Let's say you lend me $100,000, and I then walk into court one day, and you demand payment of the $100,000, and I say, I don't know what you're talking about, I've never seen you before, I never borrowed anything from you. And the court says, will you swear to that? And I say, sure, bring me out the Bible, I'll swear in the name of God. And I swear in the name of God that I have never seen you before. Right? That would be what's known as a false oath. Okay? That is a false oath. Now let's go to a vain oath. A vain oath is when someone swears, using God's name, that, say, this lectern here is in fact a lectern. Okay? Or that this lectern is in fact a chair. If he would swear one of those two oaths, he has made a vain oath. Now, of the two oaths, which do you think is worse? What? The first one, right? I mean, that's really dastardly, right? Which of the two is in the Ten Commandments? The second one, right? The vain oath is in the Ten Commandments, not the false oath. Why is the vain oath in the commandments? If anything, the false oath should be there. Plus, the way the rabbis interpreted it, the vain oath is a very, very particular kind of command. I mean, not to swear that the lectern is a lectern. It's a very particular kind of command. It doesn't seem general enough to belong in the Ten Commandments. So we might have some complaints against commandment number three. Let's move on to commandment number four. Commandment number four is the Sabbath, right? The Sabbath, I'm right? Yes, commandment number four, keep the Sabbath, right? Okay, so we have any problems with keep the Sabbath? Does that sound pretty good, pretty fundamental, basic? What? Okay, what's that, details? It goes into details, but we might say broadly speaking, right? Okay, once we have the Sabbath, so we'll get into details, but basically speaking, it's a pretty broad command. It belongs to it. Although, the truth is, the Sabbath is the only ritual command in the entire Ten Commandments. You don't have circumcision in there, you don't have Yom Kippur in there, you don't have Sukkot in there, none of the other holidays, the Beis Hamikdash, none of that. You might say, out of all the ritual commands, is Shabbos really the most important? So maybe it is. But it's intriguing that it's the only ritual command that's in the Ten Commandments. All right, so let's keep Shabbos in there for now. Okay, so moving on. We have commandment number five. Commandment number five is honor your father and mother. Basic, fundamental, important. Yes? All right, we'll keep it. Do not murder, right? Pretty important, fundamental, basic. Yes, okay. All right, do not commit adultery. Also pretty important. Yes. All right, do not steal. Important, commandment number eight. Yes, all right. However, there is a little problem, which is the way the sages understand do not steal, it starts to get complicated. So you know how the rabbis interpret do not steal? Kidnapping. What's wrong with do not steal being kidnapping and that being in the Ten Commandments? You might say, First of all, if there's a command against stealing in the Torah, in general, now as the rabbis say, there is a command against stealing in the Torah, but that's elsewhere in the Torah. The command here is the command against kidnapping. Okay, so which of the two do you think should be in the Ten Commandments? The command against kidnapping or the command against stealing? I would say, so no, certainly kidnapping might be a worse crime, right? But which is more general and which is more specific? Presumably kidnapping is a subcategory of stealing in general. And if so, if we go back to our theory that we want the more general commands in here, that, because you need to get 60.3 commands under this thing, right? So how do you use stealing? It's difficult to get 60 commands under kidnapping, right? So that is a, so we might make, you know, we would have a problem with that. Moving on to commandment number 9. Commandment number 9 is, do not bear false witness against your neighbor. Can you raise an objection against that? Now, I'm not objecting to the principle. It's a very nice principle. But would you object to that being included in your table of contents? Yes. Specific. Right? It's seemingly you could get a broader category in there than do not lie about your neighbor in court. What's the broader category? What's that? What about do not lie? There's a law in the Torah, Midvar Sheker Tirchak, stay far away from lying. That's not in the Ten Commandments. Put that in the Ten Commandments and let this be a subcategory. Okay? Then we get to do not covet. Commandment number 10, do not covet. It's a very nice, very wonderful command, do not covet, right? It tugs at our heartstrings. It's a very moral-sounding command. But the truth is, there's many moral-sounding, wonderful commands which do not make it in the Ten Commandments. But the truth is, there's many moral-sounding, wonderful commands which do not make it in the Ten Commandments. You have to ask yourself to look good and hard and say, why is this the very nice moral command which makes it into the Ten Commandments and not any of the others? Let me give you some examples. What are some very nice moral commands that don't make it in the Ten Commandments? Like really nice, you know, love your neighbors yourself kind of commands. First of all, love your neighbors yourself in general is a command, but it's not in the Ten Commandments. Second of all, what about, let's say, the commandment to give charity? It's not in the Ten Commandments. There's no commandment to pray in the Ten Commandments. What about Lo Tamad Al Dam Re'acha? Don't stand by while your brother's blood flows, right? Come to the aid of your brother in need. That is not in the Ten Commandments. What about be nice to the widow and orphan? What about always pursue justice and don't take bribes and pursue justice vigilantly? That's not in the Ten Commandments. What about Kedoshim Tiyu? Right? The law, according to the way the medieval commentators tend to understand it, that you should live according to the spirit of the law, not just according to the letter of the law. You should be punctilious in the letter of the law, but never allow the spirit of the law to elude you. That's a very nice general command. It's not in the Ten Commandments. So, we've got lots of very nice general commands which we could have in the Ten Commandments, but of all of them, do not covet is what makes it. Nothing against do not covet, but why specifically that, as opposed to any of the others, right? Alright, so we're done with our meeting. And we finish marking up this list of commands. We stuff it back into the FedEx envelope, and boom, it's off, and we notice that it sort of levitates out of the room, right? And we're very surprised by this. But amazingly, an hour and a half, it's back. And there is a new FedEx envelope on our desk, right? And it is the revised edition, right? Taking into account all of our comments. So we eagerly open the strip, and we take it, and we flip through the pages, and dismayed, we realize that it is exactly the same version as the first one, with a little sticky note on top. I liked it the way I had it. Right? So, you figure out what I meant. That's right. That's right. So you figure out what I meant. So now we have to devote the rest of our meeting to trying to figure out why it was that we have the Ten Commandments exactly as they are, right? And we must have gone wrong somewhere. So either Rabbi Chiswell and Stan are wrong, and maybe it's not a good table of contents at all, or maybe it is a good table of contents, but the way we went about our meeting is wrong, and there's a different structure being envisioned for this table of contents than what we had in mind. What I'd like to suggest to you is that very theory. I'd like to suggest to you tonight that Stan and Rabbi Chiswell are right. It is the structure for the Ten Commandments, but it's not necessarily that you could put 60.3 commandments in each of these, but that it works as a structure to the Torah on another level. I'd like to try to flesh out to you why I think that's the case, how it is that there is a sort of hidden structure to the Ten Commandments, which gives a framework for the entire Torah, which in fact is very relevant to our lives on a day-to-day basis. So let me devote our remaining minutes, which are quite few, alas, to trying to make clear how that is so. One can ask the facetious sounding question, which is not so facetious. It's a true question, which is, why did God have to write the Ten Commandments on two tablets? Could he not have found one stone big enough for all of them? Right? Or maybe he could just write in 10-point type, you know, like on the computers, you can like squish it up real small. Would have been a lot easier for Moshe to make it down that mountaintop with only one tablet to carry. It's difficult. You got two tablets in your arms, you're making it down, all these roots and branches. It's really tough. So why put it on two tablets? If the Ten Commandments are on two tablets, we can only conclude one thing. There's one general principle that needs to guide us. If we know that there's two tablets, what do we make of the fact that there are two tablets? What do you say? It's just like those were the only stones around, you know? Why are there two tablets? What do we understand from that?
You said that there are two general principles.
Right, so it must be that there are two categories here. There must be that there's two general basic categories, whatever they are, right, that break up the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments themselves are broken up into two categories. There's one tablet, and there's the other tablet. Clearly, that's true. Now we just have to figure out what the categories are, okay? So let's figure out what the categories are. All right, so what? All right, so everyone says, well, it's obvious what the categories are. The commandments are, one of those are man-to-man, right? Relationships that govern man and its fellow man. The other is relationships that govern man and God. Now, that sounds like an attractive theory, but if you actually go through the list, there's a little fly in the ointment. Let's actually go through it. Commandment number one, I am the Lord your God, between man and God. Do not have any idols between man and God, okay? Do not take the Lord's name in vain between man and God, okay? Commandment number four, keep the Shabbos between man and God. Commandment number five, honor your parents between man and
God.
Whoops, hold on one second. The last time I checked, your parents were people, right? They were not, right? Your parents are people. So, honor your parents doesn't mean honor God. It means honor your parents, right? So your parents are people. So you can't say that the first list are relationships between you and God, because it would be fine if it was like four and six. You know, if we stopped it after the fourth commandment and just moved the last one onto the next tablet, we'd be fine. You know, we could just cut it up that way. But we can't. We're stuck with this little fly in the ointment. So it must be that the first five commandments are not commandments between man and God. However, it's still true that there are two categories here. So I revisit this question to you. What are the two categories? If they're not between man and God and man, what are they? In other words, just to help you visualize this, I'd like you to remember, or I'd like you to imagine for a moment that you were back taking the SATs, right, many years ago, right? And on the SATs, remember there's that ubiquitous question, what is the best title for this paragraph? You remember those questions? What is the best title for this paragraph? So imagine they give you the first five of the Ten Commandments with the question, what is the best title for this paragraph? Relationships between man and who? Okay, good. Authority or superiors. Both God and your parents are authority or superiors. Now, why are they your authority and your superiors? For a very specific reason. Right. Because they created you. So you might say it's relationship between man and his creators, plural. Right? The first set of tablets is the relationships between man and his creators. And the second set of tablets, if the first set is man and his creators, so what's the second set? Man and his peers, right? In other words, there's two kinds of relationships that I can have, right? I can have, why is it that I honor my parents? Do I honor my parents because they're smarter than me? What if I'm smarter than them? I don't have to honor them anymore, right? No, you still have to honor your parents. If you don't honor your parents because you don't honor your parents because they're smarter than you, do you honor them because they have more life experience than you? No. Right? What if your parents, God forbid, have Alzheimer's, they don't have so much life experience anymore and they aren't so wise? So what then? Right? So you still honor your parents. There's only one reason why you honor your parents. And what's that? Because they created you. It's not because they're such nice people. It's because they created you. That's the only reason. And that will never change. And therefore, you can never be the peer of your parents. Because that fact about your relationship will never, ever change, no matter what happens. Right? It's only because of that that you honor your parents. There's fundamentally two different kinds of relationships you can have in the world. One is the relationship that I have with my creators. That's an up-and-down relationship. There's no way that relationship gets equalized. Then there's everybody else in the world. Everybody else in the world is basically my peer, right? More or less. they are my peers. They are horizontal relationships. There's relationships that go like this, and there's relationships that go like this. Two kinds of relationships. So I'd like you to bring you back to the title of the book. Right? What might be the title of the book? Could you pick out a commandment that would work as the title of the book? So this actually is not such a facetious question. The Talmud itself asks this question, or actually, there's that famous story of Hillel and the convert. Essentially, the story between Hillel and the convert is that question. The convert comes to Hillel and says, teach me the entire Torah on one foot. Comes to Shammai first, and Shammai throws him out. Comes to Hillel, and Hillel is willing to teach him the entire Torah on one foot. And what does he do? He takes one commandment and paraphrases it. He takes love your neighbor as yourself and paraphrases it as my dasani loch, that which is hateful to you, l'chabrach losava, don't do to your fellow. That's the whole Torah. All the rest is commentary. Now go and learn it. What Hillel was essentially doing was saying, if you want the whole Torah in one command, that command is the title of the book. If I had to sum it all up in one command, that's the title. Now Rashi there asks the following question. Rashi says, that's a bad title, right? Because it doesn't cover the whole book, right? It only covers part of the book. What part of the book does that command cover? That which is the way you want to be treated, be nice to your friends. Who does it cover?
Peers.
It doesn't cover the God part, right? Who's God? He's chopped liver. How come you're leaving out God, right? So Rashi says, no, it covers God too. Because when it says, that which is hateful to you, don't do to your friend, don't do to your rea, don't do to your neighbor is God too. Right? It's not just people neighbors, it's God neighbor also. Which is to say that if you want to sum up the entire Torah, it is, relate to God and to people as you would want God and people to relate to you. Okay? Both God and people. What that means fundamentally is, that you can say what the Torah is all about is that principle of relating to others, whether they're God or people, whether they're peers or creators, as you would want yourself to be related to. But, that having been said, there still is a difference to how I relate to creators and how I relate to peers. Right? Fundamentally, there's one principle that guides my relationship with parents and with peers. Relate to them as I would want to be related to, but that doesn't mean that you treat your parents and your peers the same way. So there is a guiding principle which is similar, but there are different expressions of that principle depending upon if I'm relating to a peer or if I'm relating to a parent. What I think that means in real life is the following theory that I'd like to flesh out to you. I would like to make the following suggestion, that there are not, in fact, 10 commandments. That there are, in fact, only 5. Okay? Forget everything you know about the 10 commandments. There are actually only 5. You've been misled these entire... I hate to tell you this, but you've been misled this entire time. You should revise all the textbooks. But what I mean to say is not that there aren't 10 commandments, but there's really only 5 principles. What I'd like to suggest to you is that the 10 commandments are really a mirror. That there are 5 basic principles of relationships. There are 5 basic principles of what's required to be the foundation of what Hillel is talking about. My dasani lach l'chavrach losava, that which is hateful to you, don't do to your friend. There are 10 expressions of those 5 principles. Because the way those principles play out in the world of creators looks like one thing, and the way it plays out in the world of peers looks like another thing. So that we see 10 commandments, but in fact there's only 5 principles, and you could sort of take these 10 commandments up here and turn them in on each other, almost as if they're mirror images of each other. That you'll be able to identify in each slot, through 1 through 5, a principle. There's a fundamental principle. There are 5 principles that form the basis for being able to relate to others the way you would want to be related to if you were in their position. If you have those 5 principles sewn up, then you can do what Hillel asks of you. You can do what the Torah asks of you of how to relate to others. But if you don't have those 5 principles, you'll never ever be successful in doing that. There are 10 commandments that express those 5 principles. Let's see how that's so. I'd like to go through the list of the 10 commandments and show you why I believe that's so. Let's start we're going to go through each command on each side and see if there is a common principle which these 2 commands express. Let's begin with commandment number 1, Anochi Hashem Elokecha lo tirtzach. The first principle is expressed on side number 1, as I am the Lord your God. It's expressed on side number 2 as do not murder. Okay? Which means that there would be a basic principle, right, of how I relate to others, that expresses itself symbolically in the world of creators as, I am the Lord your God, a recognition of God, and expresses itself symbolically in the world of peers as do not murder, what would that principle then be? What is the basic first principle of relationships which is expressed in these two different commands? Yes?
Acknowledging the other's existence.
Exactly. Acknowledging the existence of the other. The very first thing that I need to do before I relate to you is I have to come to grips with the fact that you exist. An uncomfortable fact, by the way, because life is much easier if only I exist, or if I can make it so that only I exist. The infant comes into the world thinking that basically only it exists. Gradually it learns that there is a world outside of it. If I want to be infantile in my life, it would be nice on some infantile level to imagine that the whole world is out there to serve me, right? And on one level or another, and there's basically nobody, and if somebody asserts their independent will too strongly, what do? Wipe them out, right? So principle number one is don't give into the temptation to disregard the existence of the other and wipe them out, right? But rather recognize that existence and come to terms with them as a separate existence that's expressed symbolically and do not murder in the world of peers. And what about God? Right? I can't wipe out God, right? Can't kill God, but what's the next best thing you can do? The next best thing you can do if you want to get rid of God is just don't believe in him, right? Ignore him. Don't recognize his existence. So principle number one is don't do that, right? Recognize the existence of the other. If it's God, come to terms with his existence, recognize that he's there. And if it's man, don't give in to the temptation to murder, but come to grips and acknowledge the existence of the other. For command principle number one. What's principle number two? Principle number two is, Lo yelecha lehim achrim al panai, do not give in to idolatry, don't have any other gods before me. That is the beginning of principle number two, and that's followed up in the world of peers with adultery. Commandment against adultery. So I ask you, what is the common principle expressed by these two commands? A, not to commit idolatry. Literally, do not have, remember the language? Do not have any other gods before me, that language of before me that we were so puzzled with, in my presence, because I am a jealous God. And do not commit adultery. What is the common denominator? What is the common principle that we're being asked to recognize here? What? Okay, respect of others, but that's too general. Let's pin it down a little bit more. It is respect in a certain kind of way. What? Let's get the most specific formulation of this principle that we can. What's the common denominator between adultery and idolatry? Okay, first of all, listen to the words, the Latin here, monotheism and monogamy, right? What are we really saying? What we're really saying is, right, there's only one, or allegiance to one in a very special kind of relationship, which means that there are sacred relationships that we can have. A sacred creator relationship is the relationship of worship that we between us and the one God. But there's not just sacred relationships in the world of creators, there's also sacred relationships in the world of peers, and that's called marriage, right? Marriage is also a sacred relationship. When you by the way, it's no coincidence that the Hebrew word for marriage is kiddushin, right? And kiddushin literally means holiness, right? There's an aspect of sacredness. And one of the hallmarks of sacred relationships, in other words, I can love lots of people, right? But that doesn't mean that I can have affairs in my marriage, because there's a difference between general love and sacred love. Sacred love demands an exclusive kind of relationship, and sacred worship demands an exclusive kind of relationship. And what happens when that exclusive relationship is threatened? What is the one thing in human relationships that inspires the most possible jealousy than anything else? The threat of adultery, right? The threat of that most sacred relationship becoming violated by mixing in a relationship that someone doesn't belong. What's adultery? Adultery is not that you divorce the spouse, right, and go live with someone else. It's that you maintain a relationship with that spouse, but cheat on the side by mixing in a relationship with something that doesn't belong, and that betrays the sacred relationship with the other. That's exactly what idolatry is. With idolatry, I also have a sacred relationship with one God, right? And God says, do not have any other gods before me, which means in my presence, while you maintain a relationship with me, don't cheat by engaging in mistresses, as it were, by engaging in relationships with other gods right? That inspires jealousy, the same way that it inspires jealousy in human relationships. I also seek to safeguard the sanctity of our relationship, and if I see the threat of you mixing in things that doesn't belong into our relationship, I also react with jealousy. I'm a jealous God. I want to maintain the sanctity of that relationship. So principle number two is that don't destroy a sacred relationship, right, by mixing in an allegiance to something that doesn't belong, either worship of another God in the world of creators or a mistress, as it were, or some kind of relationship in marital affairs in number two. By the way, it's no coincidence also that when the Jews were guilty of idolatry, the prophets castigated them with the metaphor of being adulterous, right? They were seen as adulterers, right? Why? Because that's exactly the same principle. What's principle number three? I'm sorry, I can't take questions now because I'm already over. Okay, principle number three. What's principle number three? Principle number three is, Lo tisa shem elokech lashav, do not take God's name in vain, and do not steal. Okay? Is there a common principle being expressed in do not take God's name in vain and do not steal? Difficult to see. What is it? Do not take God's name in vain, do not steal. First of all, listen to the Hebrew.
Steal is to kidnap.
Okay, now let's go to the rabbinic interpretation. The rabbinic interpretation is do not kidnap and do not swear that the lectern is a lectern. So we can either see it on the rabbinic level or the biblical level. On the rabbinic level, it would be an equivalence between kidnapping on the one hand and swearing that the lectern is a lectern on the other hand. On the biblical level, it would be do not steal on the one hand and do not take God's name in vain on the other. Let's look at both of those levels. Let's start with the Hebrew. How do you say do not take God's name in vain in Hebrew? Lo tisa et shem elokech lashav. Translate tisa for me. What is lo tisa? Do not tisa. What does tisa mean? Tisa means carry off, lift up and carry off. Do not lift up and carry off God's name in vain. What does that metaphor sound like to you? Sounds like stealing, as it were, right? In other words, the language of stealing is used. What really is stealing? What does stealing do? What's the problem with stealing in a relationship? If somebody steals against you, how do you feel?
Violated.
You feel violated. Have you ever had your home broken into? You come, you see the lights, right? What's the first emotion that you feel? You feel violated, right? Right? You destroy a relationship by attacking somebody's property. You violate them by violating property. We sort of have concentric circles of self. We might see our body as one level of self. We might see our marriage as another level of self. We might see what we own, right, as another level of self, our property. You can violate someone by attacking themselves and by killing them. You can violate someone by attacking a marriage, right, in a sacred relationship, commandment number two. You can violate someone by going a little farther out from the core, by attacking their possessions and violating them that way. It's actually almost the same as rape, the feeling of stealing. It's just it attacks the possessions instead of the body, just a little bit farther out in the orbit. Now, think about it this way. What is the worst kind of stealing? What's the violation of stealing? Here I have these precious things, and someone's taken my precious things and used them for their own ends in a trivial kind of way. It's very cheapening, right? What's the most precious thing that I have? My name or my child, right? If someone kidnaps my child and holds them for ransom, right, there's no greater possession, there's no greater thing that I have that could be used for as cheap a thing as someone taking my child and using it. It's the greatest possible violation through property. In the world of creators, the greatest possible violation through property, as it were, is that God's most precious thing is his name. God says you can take my name for certain things when it's important, but to take my name in a trivial way, right, to take my name, to swear that this lectern is a lectern, is to take my most precious thing, my name, and to use it for the most trivial of all possible purposes, to swear that the lectern is a lectern. It's the greatest possible violation. So principle number three is, do not violate the other by misappropriating the property of the other. And that's principle number three. What's principle number four? Principle number four is, Zocher Siyom HaShabbos L'Kadsho, remember Shabbos, keep Shabbos, and Losana Bereacha Et Shaker, do not bear false witness against your neighbor. Is there a basic principle that is being expressed by these two commandments? Keep the Shabbos and do not bear false witness against your neighbor in court. Do not tell lies about your neighbor in court. Is there a fundamental principle here? Okay, good. Why do I keep Shabbos? Why do I keep Shabbos? What's the meaning of my keeping Shabbos? Why is it significant?
Ten Commandments.
And now the question is, why is it in the Ten Commandments? So why is it in the Ten Commandments? Why am I keeping Shabbos? What? Right, because God created the world in 7 days and rested on the seventh day. So I rest on the seventh day too to commemorate and to testify that in fact God is the creator of the world. Actually, I testify to two things through keeping Shabbos. I testify to Yetzias Mitzrayim, to the fact that God intervened in history and took the Jews out of Egypt, and I testify that he's the creator. What are the two most important things we know about God? Forget all the theology and all the philosophy. The two most practically speaking important things are A, that he is the creator of the world, and B, that he didn't just create the world and go to sleep, but he's still interested in the world and will intervene in the world and become involved in its affairs. The symbol of that is that he intervened in Yetzias Mitzrayim to take us out of Egypt. The two most important things we know about God, we testify to, and we tell the truth about him on Shabbos. That is why Shabbos is so important. Right? You've got to stand up and tell the truth about God. You do it by resting on the seventh day. That's why in Shul, you stand up for Vayichulu. Why do you stand up for Vayichulu? Because there's a law about how witnesses give testimony. Witnesses always have to be standing when they give testimony. So when you stand up and say that God finished his creation in 6 days and rested in the seventh day, and that's why I'm resting now, you stand up and you're bearing witness and you stand up. And that's why we often see in Shul that people will say to one another, will you say Vayichulu with me? Right? It's said in pairs. Why? Because how many witnesses need to testify to something in Jewish law? Two witnesses. You always need two witnesses to test it, to establish the veracity of an event. So we also demand two witnesses when we stand up in shul on Shabbos and say we are testifying that God created the world. Right? So principle number 4 is tell the truth about the other when push comes to shove. Tell the truth about your friend in court, right? And tell the truth about the other in your creator, and that he in fact is a creator, right? As we mentioned before, the four principles seem to be moving out in concentric circles. It starts with the self, then goes to a sacred relationship, a marriage. You can violate that. It then goes to property. You can attack someone by violating property. It then goes to what? What's the fourth level of self that it is that you can attack? It is what? Reputation. Right? Tell the truth about the other, maintain the reputation of the other by telling the truth about him. Right? That's another level of self that you can attack that's farther out. It's the fourth orbit of self, as it were. And finally, we get to principle number 5. Do we have enough time for principle number 5? That is the question. Well, we're already over time, but we'll just sneak it in real fast. Okay? Principle number 5. Right? The last principle that's needed to understand what's required to have a relationship with others and relate to them as I would want to be related to. A, I must recognize the existence of the other. B, I must safeguard the sacred relationship. C, I can't trample on property. E, D, I cannot trample on reputation. I must tell the truth about the other. And what's the last principle? It's expressed in two very strange expressions. One is Kabed es avicha ves imecha, honor your father and mother. And the second is do not covet. Right? There is a fundamental principle which is expressed in the world of peers as do not covet, and in the world of creators as honor your parents. Right? But there is a principle at stake here, and if I violate that principle in the world of creators, it looks like dishonor to my parents. It manifests itself in dishonor to my parents. And if I violate that principle in the world of peers, it manifests itself in my coveting my neighbor. What is that principle? Yes?
Gratitude.
Okay, we're getting close. Gratitude would work for parents, but it doesn't work for peers.
Why?
Because if I move in next door to Joe Schmo, and I've never met Joe Schmo before, and I start coveting his pool, and once I have his pool, I'm coveting his Jaguar, and once I have his Jaguar, I want his dog, so I'm guilty of coveting, but I'm not necessarily guilty of ingratitude. He's never done anything for me that I need to be grateful for, right? So it's not necessarily the same with gratitude, but you're very close, right? Let's just whittle it down a little bit. What is that principle? Let me put it to you this way. You might see it a little bit easier. There is a certain character flaw, right? And basically, all of these things are that there are certain character flaws that you can have, that if you don't rectify that basic character flaw, it's going to mess up your relationships. It'll mess up your relationships with people. It'll also mess up your relationships with God. Sometimes you find somebody that has not worked out in a certain area of their self, and they have problems with their relationships with people, but they also have problems with their relationships with God. Right? It's all intertwined. It may express itself differently, but it's intertwined. There's something here, there's a character flaw that's being addressed, and if you don't address it, it expresses itself in the world of creators in the temptation to dishonor your parents, and it expresses itself in the world of peers in the temptation to always covet what my neighbor has. What is that flaw? Yes?
Would it be not appreciating what you have?
Okay, good. It would be very close to not appreciating what I have. Let's try and figure it out. Let's look at coveting for a moment. Why is it that coveting is something that I can't do? What is it that I would want to covet? Why am I coveting? What does coveting mean? Never mistake, by the way, coveting for simple materialism. Coveting what other people have is not the same thing as being a materialistic person. Because if I'm materialistic, if I'm materialist, it means that I want stuff, but I don't care where it comes from. Okay? When I'm coveting, I care where it comes from. It's got to come from you. I don't just want a pool. I want your pool. I don't want just on a dog. I want your dog. And I just don't want I just don't want a car. I want your car. And once I have your car, I want your dog. And once I have your dog, I want your Jaguar. And once I have your Jaguar, I want your grass. And I'm never, right? And it's never enough. Right? Whatever I have of yours, I want more of what's yours. So why is this? What's motivating the coveting personality? Why am I doing this stuff? So I'm jealous. So what do I think? But what do I tell myself in my mind's eye? Why is it that I want this stuff and I think that once I have the next thing of yours, it's going to be enough? Why am I fooling myself? What am I telling myself? What am I thinking? Okay, yeah.
I'm entitled to everything?
But I'm not entitled to everything because then I would be entitled to all materialistic stuff. I want your stuff. Why do I want your stuff? Why do I not care? It's the same pool. Why do I want your pool? Once I have your pool, I want your car. Why do I want your stuff? No, it's not. No, because then I wouldn't want it. I would just want to destroy it. Then I could go and I could torch your stuff, right? And it wouldn't be a problem, but I'm not. I want to have it, right? I don't want to just get rid of your stuff. I want to actually, I want your stuff. Why do I want your stuff? Yes?
Lack of appreciation of what you have.
Okay, good. Or lack of appreciation of my own position in life. What am I trying to do when I covet your stuff and I want your stuff? I have this illusion, right, that everybody has a station in life. Your station in life is defined by your possessions, by your estate, right? I think that if I can just swallow up enough of your possessions, I can take uproot myself from my station in life and put myself in your station in life. I have a fundamental problem with my station in life. I think that I would rather be you than me. The way I try and attack that is by getting all this stuff of yours, but it never works because no matter how much stuff I have of yours, I never succeed in getting rid of my own station in life, so it's illusory. But I'm trying to escape the reality of who I am and become who you are. So now look at why I would want to dishonor my parents. Why would I, not many people do, but why would you want to dishonor your parents? What's the Yetzer Hara? What's the inclination? What's the drive there to say, what do I owe my parents anyway? Right? What's that drive? Why would someone want to do that? What are they trying to appropriate for themselves? Okay. What do I say to myself? I say, yeah, I'm saying like, what'd they do anyway? Some physical act they got? I mean, anyone could have done that. I virtually could have created myself. What you're trying to do is appropriate for yourself not the position of your peer, but the position of your creator, right? And principle number 5 is what? Recognize who? Recognize who you are and the unique station that you have in the world. You are not your peer, and you're not going to be your peer. And you're not going to be your creator, right? You're right here, right? And you're not there, and you're not there. So now, if you look at the Ten Commandments as a whole, and you try and figure out the whole picture, right, you find a fascinating thing. That the Ten Commandments begin with something, and they end with something. The Ten Commandments begin with what principle? Recognition, do not murder, and I am the Lord your God. Recognition of? Not just the creator, recognition of the other, right? There is another there. I must begin by recognizing that you exist, right? My peer exists and I must not murder him. My creator exists and I must recognize him. The Ten Commandments begin with recognition of the other. And they end with what?
Recognition of the
self. Right? That I exist too. The first four commandments are allowing me to internalize and recognize the inviolate boundaries of the other. It begins with not wiping out his essential self, and then it moves to the next four concentric circles of self. Honor the person's existence, honor his sacred relationships, honor his property, and honor his reputation, right? And recognize all that about him and recognize those boundaries. And then recognize that you have boundaries too. Hold on for 1 second. Recognize that you have boundaries too. That you are you, and you're not going to be your parents, right? And you are not going to be your peers. But you have a unique station in life which is worthwhile, which you ought not try to evade. Once you've done that, you've recognized the existence of the other, you've maintained the boundaries, all levels of respect that you need to have towards the other, and you've learned from that that you have boundaries too. And that he's not the only one with boundaries, but I have a place as well. And you understand that I have a place and he has a place. Then you're ready for the title of the book. Ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Love your neighbor as yourself. Because the temptation of love and the disaster that love can become is that if you start love without the Ten Commandments, you will destroy everything. Because what is love? Love is a great outpouring of myself. A great merging of myself with the other. All the boundaries between me and the other seem to dissolve. But when that happens, when I give and I give and I give, and I don't recognize boundaries, that I have a boundary and that you have a boundary, I can destroy you. I can smother you. It's like the person who walks into the Shiva household and wants to give so much stuff. They give and give and give and don't know when to be quiet and don't know when to respect the other's space and smother another with the giving. Or it's the mother who can smother a kid with overprotectiveness. Or it's incest that doesn't recognize the boundaries of the others. I love and I love and I want to give, but I don't understand the boundaries. That you have an existence and I have an existence and that there's boundaries here. Love is what life is all about. But you can't begin to undertake love without the five principles of the Ten Commandments, without understanding and respecting the existence of the other and respecting the existence of the self. And then once you understand those concentric circles of self and respect them, you can begin to reach outward and give and give and give in love. That's a paradox. You give and give in love and you break down barriers, but somehow you always keep those barriers and understand that they're there as well. Right? The two work together. You love and you work towards demolishing barriers, but it's with an understanding that there is an essential self out there, and that remains inviolate, and I remain inviolate, and then I can expand and give outward. I think this is a way that we can look at the Ten Commandments and see it not as simply something that democracy has to live by, simply that the world has to live by, but perhaps it's something that actually animates our lives on a daily basis, and really gets to what the title of the book is all about, which is doing to others the way that I would want to be treated also. Thank you very much.
We hope you have enjoyed this presentation by Rabbi David Foreman. For information on purchasing other tapes by Rabbi Foreman, please call us toll-free at 1-866-JEWISH-EXPLORATIONS. That's 1-866-539-4743. Or visit us on the web at JewishExplorations.com.